This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. There will be a discussion on Beacon Hill tomorrow that George Floyd's uncle wants to see happen. 4 years after Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police, his uncle, Selwyn Jones, has been lobbying in the Commonwealth and across the country with his nonprofit. And the goal? Pass reforms that protect against a future-long list of people who have died at the hands of police. The list that we sit with now includes Justin Root, who was fatally shot at by officers 31 times in Brookline in February of 2020. Uncle Selwyn, as he asked me to call him, came to Massachusetts this month to advocate for the Medical Civil Rights Act. It requires officers to administer medical aid to anyone they are interacting with who asks for it. And the Joint Committee on the Judiciary will take that up tomorrow. We invited Uncle Selwyn to Studio 2, and he joined us between talks at Harvard. He was clear on why the act is important.
It's a bill that gives victims, as well as police officers, an opportunity to be okay. In essence, my nephew would be alive today. When he would have bellowed, "I can't breathe," they would have had to stop and subdue him and give him medical assistance immediately instead of waiting for that 9 minutes and 29 seconds for him to die.
How do we get, Uncle Selwyn, from that moment to this? I mean, if I imagine, to the extent that I can, all the paths from that moment to today and all the paths you could have walked down, how do we get to this one?
We get to this one because of a proud black man, a proud daddy, a proud brother, a proud friend, and just a proud human being, because I grew up in the rural South. So I've seen hatred in many different forms and ways my whole life. And when I sat in my living room and watched the news on May the 26th, 2020, I'm watching it, and I just seen Ahmaud Arbery's tragic death.
In Georgia.
And I'm sitting and I'm looking, and my thought is, when are people going to stop harming people? And my sister calls me and she said, "Did you see what?" And all of a sudden, that dude that was hollering and bellowing was my nephew. And I sat back in the chair, and every bad thing that's ever happened, every bad thing that I've ever seen, every bad thing that I've ever felt just was right in my face. And I heard my big sister's baby boy say, "Mama." And it really ripped the heart out of my chest and realized that that was one of mine. That was somebody that I played with. I've changed his diaper. I've watched grow up. I've seen play ball. I've seen have kids. I've seen make mistakes and try to fix his mistakes. I've seen him move from Houston to Minneapolis to get away from a bad environment so he could become a better person and a better human being. And I seen somebody that had sorrow and sadness because his mama died a year before then. So I seen all of these things. And I immediately went to, I got to do something.
You did. Immediately you went to,
immediately,
"I got to do something."
Immediately, dear. I said, "I got to do something." And on the 27th, I went to Rapid City, South Dakota, and did a march for George, because those 3 days prior to Derek Chauvin getting arrested, the whole world was in total chaos, because that's the first time that we seen any situation like that. COVID had everybody indoors. COVID had everybody locked in to their televisions, and you seen my big sister's baby boy die probably 10,000 times in 3 days. And those that didn't believe, that didn't think that there was a privilege or there wasn't police brutality, had an opportunity to sit there and watch my nephew go from laughing, talking, begging, crying, and dying.
I want to be honest with you about something. I've never watched it. I refused to watch it.
If you haven't watched it, it's something that, if you have a heart, it's something that would break you to the core. If you are a mother, if you are a father, if you are a sister, a brother, cousin, if you have a heart to see a 6'7" man that was possibly in mental distress, asked to get put on the ground, and after he was laid on the ground, you watch somebody that had a look in his face of, I'm going to show you what power and control looks like.
Derek Chauvin.
I'm going to show you what I can do. And there's a lot of great police officers. We need them. But in particular situations, their power and control issues are not wanted, not needed. And he literally put his knee, he kept rolling his knee around my nephew's throat. And you sat there, and at 8:26 and 15 seconds, you see his eyes blink, and the life leaves him. And he kept his knee on his neck. And you had the other officers saying, hey, man, get your knee off his neck. He's done, he's done. And he was relentless at murdering my nephew. And the problem I really have is they have been put in an authoritative position. If he thought that he was going to be in prison or get in trouble, he would have never did it. It's the system that gives people the opportunity and the ability to do these things that bothers me.
That's part of what I find deeply intriguing about this journey, because he did wind up convicted.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't stop there, right? Oh. You're now moving to wanting medical civil rights. You want this next step, which is ensuring not only the fight against police brutality, but ensuring
everybody's got a chance.
Healthcare. Did it take a step of forgiveness to get to this? Or is that just, you just bypass that and you go straight?
I bypass that. I bypass that, sweetie. I bypass the grieving part. I bypass forgiving. I'm a realist. And what I saw is something that has been happening throughout our existence. How many George Floyds were they before my sister's baby boy got videotaped? There have been thousands of George Floyds. And those are the people that I want to highlight. I want, because I can't bring George back. And people ask me all the time, man, you know, tell me all the time, I'm sorry. And I immediately say, I miss my nephew, but I'm not sorry. I'm the one that has this opportunity to make a difference. Because as you said, I could be going down many, many paths, and the path I'm going for is change, it's righteousness. For that person that didn't have a camera on him, that son that died in the back of a police car because he was in there for 18 minutes when he had an opportunity to be helped. For that little kid that's walking down the street that has a hood on and get shot that don't need to be.
Trayvon Martin.
Yep, yep. So, you know, dear, it doesn't stop there. You know, sex trafficking, missing persons, disenfranchised people, homeless. You know, dear, I am embarking upon a world of change. And, you know, and I'm using the energy and the platform that my nephew gave me from those 9 minutes and 29 seconds to make a difference.
When you come to a place like Boston, you go to compel people to support something like medical civil rights, you talk about grieving and social action. I have to imagine every community brings you their stories. So, you know, hear our story of Justin Root, that Jennifer Root Bannon carries forward. Justin was killed by police in February of 2020. We've talked with Jennifer here on the show.
Jen's my girl. I'll see her, and I talked to her about 20 minutes ago. I'll see her later on tonight. With one person, they probably know 10. They know 10. And that's one of the things that Hope 929, we have created a base where we have a pin and a map for every state. We have a central location, a Charlotte, a Durham, a Boston, a New York, a Brooklyn, a D.C., a Maryland, a Virginia.
In Atlanta, Atlanta, Cleveland.
You name it. You name it. Out of that one pen, there's probably 1,000 people connected to that. So when you're talking about what we're going through and what we're doing, you're talking about hundreds and thousands of people that have perished because somebody made a mistake, because somebody did not give somebody medical attention when they were in distress, whether it's physical or mental.
We are here with Selwyn Jones, uncle of George Floyd and co-founder of Hope 929 Foundation. You know, so we've got the pushpins. We've got the thousands of people. You said someone makes a mistake. Sometimes it's a mistake. Sometimes it's brutality. Sometimes it's murder. I assume, and maybe I shouldn't assume, that you believe this access to medical care fits in all of those boxes.
Every last one of them, my dear.
And it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Black, white, blue, green, yellow, purple, orange, tall, short, skinny. Doesn't matter. Why not give that person an opportunity to live? Because this is all about a preservation of life. We just watched the Randy Cox video, and he was thrown in the back of a police transport van, and he was laying in the back, and he physically said and visually shown signs of unresponsiveness. They drug him out of the van. They drug him through the police department. They laid him in a cell. And then when they realized that he was hurt, he had to go have immediate surgery, and he's paralyzed from the neck down.
This is New Haven, Connecticut.
Yep. Now, if they would have followed the procedure, and once he said, "I'm hurt," and let the ambulance take him, he might be able to walk today. He might be able to use his hands or his arms or his legs. But because of that deflection of time, because of that wait period, things got worse and worse.
Uncle Selwyn, is there anybody who's mad at you because you're not more mad?
I hear that. You know, you should be madder than heck. You should hate the police. Why? We need the police. Just like there's bad Caucasian people, they're bad African Americans, they're bad Asians, they're bad Hispanics, they're bad teachers, they're bad firemen. The world is made of plenty of good, but those in particular things that are bad really rear their ugly face in certain times. So, you know, dear, I'm moving forward. I cannot bring doors back. But what I can do is I can spread my word. I can motivate people so we can prevent those things that we've been seeing. And that's all I want to do, man, is I want to prevent and preserve life. I want to build better communities. You know, I want to make kids financial literate. I want to make adults financial literate. You know, we're creating a reentry program for the Native American reservations in South Dakota. So, you know, dear, all I want to do is take what my nephew gave me and take the people around me. And it's not about me. It's about we. It's about what we can do. You giving me an opportunity to sit here and communicate with you and hear my story. My friends that are with me, my co-founder, we are on a journey to create a better community and a better world.
Last year, this is my last question for you. Last year, I was having a conversation with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking to me about when her mother died. And she refers to her mother as having transitioned. And she talked about the piece of her mother's power that she kept and her mother's transition. Assuming George transitioned, and one day you will too.
Mm-hmm.
What will he say to you when you see him again?
Uncle, you sure wouldn't stop talking, did you, man? I knew you were going to have my back. You know, we laughed, we joked. He was, every time I saw him, he picked me up, you know, because he grew, big boy. And it was never, I'll see you later. It was never a goodbye, I'll see you later. And the last time I saw him was 2 weeks before before the misfortunate incident happened. And it was like, man, I'll see you in a little while. I'll call you for your birthday. My birthday is on the 22nd of May. He died on the 25th of May. I looked on my phone and he had texted me, "Happy birthday, Unc." I still have that phone. I still have that happy birthday on it. So, you know, I think about him quite regularly, and I think about the smiles. I think about the jokes, you know, big happy person. But I can't get the look out of my mind and how he looked in his last minute of life when he was gasping for air, when he told them, "Don't kill me." And that I see every night, every day. And that is what keeps me fighting, because I know he's looking at me and I know he's saying, "You're doing right by me." And that's all I want to do. I want to do right by him. I want to do right by my babies, your grandbabies. We only come here for a short period of time. Why not make it a better world than when we leave, than when we came in? Because me and you, which we both know that we're long in the tooth, around the same length, and we've seen a lot of stuff in this lifetime. We've seen way too many things that we shouldn't have seen. And a lot of them was caused by people not caring. Not giving a damn. And if I could have that one little baby come to me and to Uncle Selwyn, something you said, I heard you speak 10 years ago, and I'm graduating Harvard, police officer, doctor, lawyer, nuclear physicist, whatever. I know that I was effective. And all I'm trying to do is just be effective and let people hear a story about somebody that has fought and struggled and battled and came out on the other side of that storm as a pretty good person that wants to create a lot of good things around me.
We spoke with Selwyn Jones, co-founder of the nonprofit Hope 929 and uncle of George Floyd, when he was in town earlier this month. And WBUR senior correspondent Deb Becker joins us now. She reported on the Justin Root case and has covered other aspects of policing over the years. Deb, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So just one reaction, Deb, to what you just heard?
Oh, well, it's heartbreaking, right, Tiziana? I mean, families affected by violence during police interactions, these stories and stories like Selwyn Jones are just so hard to hear. And we know, right, that this is a problem. And there have been a variety of steps taken in the years since George Floyd's killing in 2020 to improve police training, 911 response, especially to behavioral health crises. But, you know, I also felt it was inspiring to hear what Selwyn Jones said, that the people are not, you know, getting bitter and giving up, but trying to improve things for others and change the system to prevent future tragedies. And we should say this Medical Civil Rights Act proposed for Massachusetts is part of the Medical Civil Rights Initiative. And that's a committee of six physicians and a retired judge. And they drafted this proposed legislation and they want to see it in every state. Connecticut did become the first state to pass a Medical Civil Rights Act last year. And eventually, I think the goal is for a federal bill.
So, Deb, it was first proposed to the legislature here in 2021. Tomorrow, there will be a report out about it. The prospects of it making meaningful progress this session here in our legislature?
Well, there's been quite a push from advocates. And then there was a report in the Boston Globe last year that found that nearly 60% of people in Massachusetts who were fatally shot by police since 2016 had either been experiencing a mental health crisis or had mental illness. So I think it's possible, but there are still a lot of questions about the details. How would a medical emergency be defined by police? What if someone is violent? Should there be more education about calling mental health hotlines instead? I think there are still some outstanding questions.
And so, Deb, what do you watch for now?
I think we watch for how this report comes out, what specifically it says, what questions lawmakers have, and if some of those details have been answered to their satisfaction.
Deb, you mentioned the mental health hotline. That's 988. People can call that or text, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, correct?
Right, but that does not send a responder. And there are some communities that have their own separate response teams if there is a behavioral health crisis. So folks do not have to call 911, which would require a police officer. And dispatchers are being trained in some communities across the state to be able to differentiate and send alternate response teams to a call that wouldn't necessarily involve a police officer.
All right, Deborah Becker, WBURC, New York correspondent. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We heard from George Floyd's uncle, Selwyn Jones. He came to Massachusetts 4 years after the murder of his nephew by Minneapolis police to advocate for passage of a medical civil rights act. And as he told us, it's part of a long journey of advocacy for justice since the day that he was watching a man die on television and realized that it was his family. We want to get reactions to his work from leaders here and take stock on our own progress, our own well-being, and our own future here in the Commonwealth, just 1 month shy of 4 years since that horrible event unfolded. We have three guests here in the studio for that conversation. Jennifer Root Bannon, co-founder and co-director of the Local Impacted Families Coalition. She is Justin Root's sister. Michael Curry, president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National Board of Directors for the NAACP. And Reverend Mariama White Hammond, who is founding pastor at the New Roots AME Church. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
And Reverend Mariama, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here.
I want to create space first to react, and not in a voyeuristic way. The challenge of a retelling, Michael, is to move past voyeurism and to a place that takes us somewhere. And so with that in mind, I want to invite you to react to what we heard from Selwyn Jones so far.
Well, you know, I couldn't help but think about, as I was listening to him, I used to say when people would ask me, what made Dr. King, what made Ida B. Wells, what made John Lewis, what made them do what they do? And I used to say the back of the bus pushed them to the front of the movement, right? It was the experience of being treated that way that made the leader that they became. And in this case, as I listen to Selwyn and I listen to so many others who've lost family members here and across the country, it pushed them to the front of the movement, right? They became committed, though they had jobs and families, they had aspirations, ambitions. This became the dominant thing in their lives because they needed society to change. They needed people to wake up. So when I listen to him, I just think about the blessing that came out of this, which is him and his family. I've met the Floyd family on many occasions at NAACP activities. And I think about how optimistic I am to have their voice and their activism here and across the country. This is a critical time, and we need leaders like that now.
Jennifer, is that you? Your experience with Justin, did it push you from a time of family and job and living your own life into a movement that you did not ask to be a part of?
Oh, I could have never imagined how it changed my life. It's like taking someone and dropping a bomb right in the middle of it. And it's, you know, when I hear someone talk about grieving, I haven't grieved. I can't grieve. You know, impacted family members all have this thing where we're like, we can't grieve. We have to just keep fighting, but we also have to keep telling our stories. And we do need to, you know, not have this be about a moment, but a movement.
Reverend Mariama.
The thing that sort of, for me, just I realized to some extent that I'm blessed that there is there are a couple of my family members who could have, like, that could have been the story. My cousin who was shot, not by the police, but remember seeing him on the cover of the Herald. And it just could have been different. You know, I just think about how much it matters. I think about Kareem Burry, who was a young person in one of my program, amazing, full of promise. And it was a matter of minutes about whether or not he got the medical care that could have saved his life. And now every year on my birthday, I remember him. And so I'm, you know, I can talk policy, but really right now I'm just, so aware of how life and death hangs in the balance of how quickly people get the help that they need or not.
So, you know, in our time here on the show today, and, you know, it's interesting, I had that conversation, but listening to it again, there's no distance between then and now, right? I'm not fighting, you know, the emotional response to it any less now than then. And so I think before we do the policy piece, and we will, I do think it's important to stay in this space. And I am struck by what all three of you said. But Jennifer, one thing that really strikes me is we haven't grieved. And we talk all the time about how important grief is. And Selwyn Jones said, I moved right past the grief. I skipped the grief. I skipped the forgiveness. I bypassed all of that. And one of the things that I wonder is, as you pursue the movement, is there something that we could do as a community to make space for your grief, even as you do this other hard work? We're a community. How do we help make space for your grief, even as there's other hard work to be done?
We need more people to join this movement. We need more people to say, that could have been me. That could have been my loved one. That could have been my friend, my coworker. We need people to really get involved with changing legislation that's going to have a more positive outcome in saving people's lives. That's the only way I can feel some relief, that we're going to be saving lives together. And I feel like I'm in a constant state of, you know, educating people about all the different avenues and barriers and roadblocks that, you know, I've had to come across in order to get to the truth of what actually really happened to Justin. And I just think that if the community got more involved and actually made this part of a movement and not a moment, not, you know, a news splash about another person killed and it goes all across the country, people get upset and then it's just old news next, you know, it's old news. It's not old news. It's news for us every single day. Every impacted family member, you hear about other people being killed. It's you're in a constant state of being, you know, poked with this PTSD. But I am going to take that pain and, you know, turn it into purpose.
And I have to do this for our listeners so they understand, mm-hmm. For those who may not know the story. So as briefly as I can, in February 2020, Justin is having a crisis. He's outside Boston Medical Center, has an interaction with security guards there. It seems that there's a shot that's fired there. He's wounded. He gets in a vehicle. He's chased into Brookline. In the end, he has possession of what the police say they think is a firearm. It's a BB gun. 31 shots are fired at him in a period of 3 seconds, and he is fatally wounded and dies in Brookline. And I'm sorry to be dispassionate about that, but I want our listeners to understand what that piece of the story is as we have this conversation. Michael Curry, a lot of nodding. I really don't need to ask you a question. I really just need to turn the mic over to you.
I was thinking about the mental health work that I do, right? We're doing a lot of work on the community health center space around mental health. And I always say the caboose of our healthcare system has been the mental health, right? We've not prioritized mental health. In the context of racial justice and the many black families that I've talked to and I know Mariam has talked to that have experienced the injustice of police violence, I say black don't crack, but the cracking's on the inside, right? We've been resilient. Our skin is resilient. But I can tell you as a person who's met with families who've lost loved one, they're cracking, right? So they can bypass the grief. They turn that into action. But there is something to suffering in relationships, in their own personal fulfillment, their travel, all those things that we all aspire for. So when I think about your story and Justin's story, because it's bigger than race, that when you've dealt with injustice and there's no recourse, there's no resolution for it, and there's no mental health services for it, you're cracking in some way. And we as a society got to prioritize mental health to make sure these families. I remember meeting with Commissioner Evans in the wake of the shooting on Humboldt Avenue when the young man.
Former Boston Police Commissioner.
Young man got out of the car and shot the Boston cop directly in the face. It was national news. And I was there on the scene within a few minutes after. I went to the hospital, which surprised many police officers, that I actually went to BMC to be there for the police officer who was shot, just as I was on Humboldt Ave to be there to understand what happened and why they didn't cover up the body immediately. I tell you this story to say this, that in the wake of that, about a week later, the family came to the NAACP meeting, the family of the young man that was shot on Blue Avenue, on Humboldt Avenue. And it was grief. They should not have been at that meeting. They should have been in an environment that had mental health services. And the young woman who stood up, who was his sister, and she said to me, she said, "Michael, I don't know if my brother did what they're saying he did, but you have no idea what he endured in his lifetime. You have no idea the trauma, the abuse that he experienced that may have led him to that. That never was lost on me, that we didn't have mental health services and we end up seeing it later in life." So it's the families who've been victimized, the victimizer, the perpetrator. We just don't have an honest conversation about it, which is what this reminds me of.
You know, I think what's so devastating about this, especially as someone who's had the opportunity to travel to other places, there's a lot of pain everywhere. And we've got to really work to shift that. We've got to slow down and make time for the things that really matter. And we are the only place in the world that allows people to be gunned down in the way that they are on so many fronts. People literally ask me, like, what is wrong over there? Police forces in many other parts of the world are not even allowed to carry the kinds of weapons that we have. People don't have access to the kind of firearms that we have. You are not hunting with an AR-15. If you can't hit a deer with a regular rifle, then go study and learn. No other place is it like this. And I think I am both concerned about the deep pain, because it doesn't just show up that way. For some of us, we've lost family members to addiction because that's just the way that they worked out the deep pain. But I just can't understand why we feel like this is the best we can do. Because part of the challenge that Jennifer is raising is that we've kind of come to a place where we accept that we're just going to let it keep going like this.
Everyone's nodding.
Yeah, weather.
We're going to just let, oh, mm-hmm. That's another terrible mass shooting. Oh, that's another police killing. Oh, I guess there's nothing we can do. And there is mm-hmm. something we can do. It doesn't fix all the suffering, but maybe we could make it a little less life and death. My cousin, the one that I talked about, he now travels around the country teaching and training people about how to support young people who are in trauma or in crisis. It's a huge contribution. He's able to share from his lived experience. But if that bullet had taken him out, he wouldn't be here to do what he's doing now.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we're having a conversation started by Selwyn Jones, who was here this month. He's George Floyd's uncle. It's nearly 4 years since George Floyd was killed by Minneapolis police. He was here this month advocating for a medical civil rights act. We've been reflecting with Michael Curry, president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, Reverend Mariama White Hammond, founding pastor at New Roots AME Church, and Jennifer Root Bannon, co-founder and co-director of the Local Impacted Families Coalition. And just before we took a quick pause in our conversation, Reverend Mariama, you were pointing out we can't be weathered, to use Michael's term. We have to believe that there are things we can do. And Jennifer Root Bannon, Selwyn Jones mentioned that he was working with you. You care about the Medical Civil Rights Act. You're saying it is something we can do. The Judiciary Joint Committee tomorrow in Beacon Hill will be talking about it. Tell us more.
First, I think it's just important for everyone to understand that this act seeks to establish a statutory right to emergency medical care during law enforcement interactions. And I can't help to think, had the Medical Civil Rights Act been in law when Justin was shot 31 times by 6 officers while he was on the ground, covered in blood, incapacitated with nothing in his hands, there was a former EMT at his side providing aid, that these officers would not be entitled to qualified immunity because they would have not broken the law by ignoring his clear medical emergency. I've also talked with many other impacted family members across the country who have videos of their loved ones saying, "I can't breathe." We just can't ignore this. Each and every person's emergency medical need has to be first and foremost. This is a basic human right. This will save lives and it will save taxpayers costly lawsuits. And it's also important to know that this law will take the burden off, like the guessing work off of our officers. And what I really would love people to do, to take action, go on to the MALegislator.gov website, search Joint Committee on the Judiciary. You'll see that the results detail, you'll click that and it will bring you to the committee, and call each one of those persons' offices and just tell them that you support and you want to see them pass the Medical Civil Rights Act favorably out of committee. And the bill number for the Senate is S.1047. This bill will save lives, and we want everyone to join in helping to save lives and pass this legislation.
So, Michael Curry, I'm going to turn to you, but quickly before I do, Jennifer, you made reference to qualified immunity. Our listeners have heard that a lot over the years. Just to briefly, it's very complex, but to briefly summarize, it is a policy put in place based on previous court findings that say that an officer can't be pursued in court for an act unless there is previous court precedent extremely similar to the case in question that sets a previous precedent that the officer would have reason or should know about. There's more to it than that, but basically that's where we are. Michael Curry.
Yeah, well, one is, as I hear Jennifer talk about this legislation, I would think about Nero's Law and the fact that we actually passed legislation in Massachusetts to protect police dogs. Right. So we have these contradictions in society where we often don't value human life. But we should value animals.
Nero's Law. I don't know all the details, but Nero was a police dog, was
wounded.
And this allows for human transportation of canine partners.
Yeah. So training of first responders, all of that. So, it's interesting to me. One, just want to say thank you to Jennifer. I don't know how many people thank you, but I want to thank you. you are pushing what we should have done a long time ago, and there is no reason. I think sometimes I challenge the fact that so many police officers come out of military. And we've always challenged this notion that sometimes people come back from war, and they treat their engagement with people on the street like they're at a war. So you can question how people got medical care in Afghanistan or Iraq when they needed care. But when they bring that pattern of behavior back to the streets of Roxbury or Dorchester or South Boston or East Boston, and they say, well, you know what? I don't need to get you care when your back has been broken or when you've been shot several times. That is a crime. That is simply a crime. And it doesn't matter whether you are a citizen or a police officer. You should be accountable for that. But as we were saying before the show started, we give extreme deference to law enforcement. That means you do God's work, right? As we call it, God's work, but I say they do it the devil's way. That means that they are acting in a way that is not in the best interest of preserving human life, and they're letting people die. And that doesn't mean all of them are, but I don't know if it's 2% or 70%, right? Because no one's done that study. But too many of them are acting in a way that is resulting in death or injury, and that's not their job.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. Of course, we don't have anyone from law enforcement in this conversation. We're taking a very particular perspective here. And Reverend Mariama, I think about the last time that Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox was sitting here, sitting in the seat that Michael Curry is sitting in right now, and talking about the fact that it is harmful to the ability to recruit quality law enforcement officers when we have a narrative that they're bad. And that is an interesting tension in this moment. And it's a piece that, I said to you, I think, while we were taking a pause in the conversation, that this is a kitchen table I wish we could have everybody at. So I'll just pull that chair to the table too and leave it sitting at the table as we continue this conversation and then let you go wherever you want to go.
I mean, I think that the reality is, and I've seen this, honestly, with police officers, I've seen it with correctional facilities. What is true is they're not trained or qualified to make medical decisions. And so when someone says, I've got a medical issue, we should call in the people that are experts. You pause and you say, you know what? This is not my strength. But I'm not going to keep doing something that might make it worse. And so I think that's what the bill is about. It's about saying, we're not asking police officers to become EMTs. That's not what we train them to do. But when there's a moment where a medical professional is needed, pause and call the experts. Let them come and do their job, because it could be life or death. And we have to prioritize life.
If I can, to Michael Cox, commissioner, is a good friend of mine, and I was good friends with Gross, Evans, not as close.
William Gross before
Michael
Cox.
Michael Cox. Right. You know, I would say instead of blaming the person holding the mirror up, blame the image. And the reality is, for Michael Cox or for other commissioners, police departments have created a culture. And that culture has been a culture of disrespect. That culture has been a culture lacking accountability, transparency, for generations. So all of a sudden, when the media calls that out, or when society doesn't trust, which I know in the communities I came from, we didn't trust for my entire lifetime, you want to blame community or blame individual families, but not blame the system, not blame the culture that you've allowed to be created. And I tell people all the time, it's not just about a murder. I'm a civil rights activist. It's not just about when you take someone's life. It's about the false charges. It's about the over-policing. To Mariama's point about the over-militarization, there's a whole bunch of other things that make you a bad cop that don't result in murder. So I want to reinforce that, because we tend to think of the most egregious examples of being bad cops. That is not an individual cop's responsibility. That's the police department's responsibility to weed that out. And Commissioner Evans, Gross used to tell me, and I'm going to speak out of school when I say this, but it's the truth. They even have a hard time getting rid of bad cops. The most egregious of bad cops, they struggle with that as well.
Well, and I will note, again, although we've talked about this on the show before, Commissioner Cox was originally an officer who was pulled down off a fence in plain clothes and beaten by other Boston police officers, and spent years receiving pressure from inside the force, with culture of the force, to not pursue a civil rights claim against the force.
Gross had a similar story.
So well, I think that's
really
a piece
interesting
of it as well.
Because I used to work with young people who were in street organizations, and in that work, we would sometimes also be in conversations with the police. I can't tell you how often those conversations were very similar. Young people who were in what people often call gangs or street organizations had the same, often very narrow view that the police officers did. It was fascinating and challenging because they didn't have equal levels of power. But this whole notion of good guys and bad guys, and if I'm a good guy, then whatever I do, it's not bad because I'm a good guy. I'm a good guy who made a mistake. Whereas young people who were in gangs are inherently bad guys. Even if they did something good, they were like, that's an aberration. And I think the reality is, on all sides, we need to be held accountable for our actions. Not decide who's good and who's bad, because we're all good sometimes and we all got bad challenges sometimes. But the goal is, how do we amplify the best of who we are? How do we create transformative timeouts for all of us when we need them? But at the end of the day, part of the reason I think this bill becomes really important is that if you kill somebody, they never have the second chance to bring it back, to transform, to get it right. And so we need to say, the first and foremost is, people have got to, the life of individuals has to be protected. And the folks that are charged with that are our medical professionals. And in that moment, that's who should be making the decisions.
So we have just a little bit of time left, Jennifer Root Bannon, and Reverend Mariam has given us that last word on the Medical Civil Rights Act. Tell me one thing that is the best of who Justin was.
I just want to say he had the biggest heart. He definitely loved all sorts of people from all different walks of life. And he lived in Mattapan, and he would often sometimes run into people who were arguing, and he would go up to them and say, hey, let's try to work it out. He was like a peacemaker. I always feel like I hear him saying, like, yeah, Jen, you know, like I could imagine someday when I see him again, he'd be like, yeah, you were down there making some noise. And, you know, I just feel him with me. And I think one of the reasons why I haven't really grieved is that this process also makes me feel like he's still so alive in me. And he would always just say, like, we need more love in this world. And he would say, slow down, you know, like, smell the roses, enjoy people. Like, the last text I got from him was that he loved me. He goes, Jen, we got to tell people that we love them. And, you know, that's what I take with me. And he would also just, you know, he would add an E to the end of his name, making it just one. And so he would say that we are just one. And we're one world. We're one people. We need the Medical Civil Rights Act to be passed. That is something where my heart could start to heal a little bit.
Jennifer Root Bannon, co-founder and co-director of the Local Impacted Families Coalition and sister of Justin Root. Michael Curry, president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National Board of Directors of the NAACP. And Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, founding pastor at New Roots AME Church. Thanks to all three of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.